Tonight is March 26th. We're at Sherith Israel. We're usually learning in this slot Parshat HaShavua, weekly Torah portion, but tonight, like last week, we're going to focus not on the Parsha of the week, but the holiday of the month. We're going to focus on Pesach. We talked a little bit about the Haggadah, but an overview of the Haggadah last time. And tonight we're going to focus in, we're going to hone in on one aspect of the Haggadah. And I hope it'll be exciting. To me, it's very exciting. This is something I've never taught before. I gained a few insights this week that I'd like to share with you. So, the subject is, as you see at the top of the page, in the merit of righteous women of the generation. And we'll soon see where that quote comes from. I want to start with a source at the top of the page. It comes from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Psachim, page 108a to 108b. And Tractate Psachim is the tractate of the Babylonian Talmud where matters of Pesach are discussed. And it says there, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi also said, women are subject to the law of these four cups because they too were included in that miracle. Af hen hayu boto hanes. Even they were included in the miracle. Now what's going on is the following. Among the many mitzvot, the many commandments of the Seder, of Leila Seder, of the Haggadah, is the mitzvah of what we call in Hebrew, Arba Kosot, four glasses of wine. This is a mitzvah derabanan, not deraita, it's a commandment not from the Torah, but rather from the rabbis, the rabbanan. We saw last time that mitzvot from the Torah, we have the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb that has to be eaten that night. Today we don't eat it because there's no temple, but it's a mitzvah that in theory is commanded by the Torah. And then there is the matzah, and then there's the maror. The bitter herbs is the maror, and the matzah is the unleavened bread. And the fourth mitzvah, of course, is the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzhak Mitzrayim, telling the story of the Exodus. And we saw all those things commanded in chapter 12 of the book of Exodus last time. The matter of drinking four glasses of wine at the Seder, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with, is not found in the Torah at all. It's an addition of the rabbis. Now, as an addition of the rabbis, it falls under the normal laws of rabbinic Judaism, which is that women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot. I want to say that more clearly. First of all, positive time-bound. Positive means a mitzvah that women, a mitzvah that you have to do, as opposed to a mitzvah that you have to refrain from. Like, not eating meat and milk is a negative mitzvah, but having the four glasses is a positive mitzvah. So it's positive, and it's time-bound. You have to do it, not on Hanukkah, and not on Sunday nights. You have to do it on the Seder once a year at a certain time, so it's bound to time. And the rabbinic law, let me say it more clearly, the law is that women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot, both those of the Torah and also those of the rabbis. So this is a mitzvah of the rabbis. It's positive time-bound. You'd expect women to be exempt. But the Talmud says that women are obligated, it's an exception, even though it's positive and time-bound, they are obligated, men and women, women as well as men, because they too were included in that miracle. They meaning women. Now what does it mean that they too were included in that miracle? Well, before I answer the question, I'll tell you that this exact same phrase, they too were included in the miracle, appears in the context in the Talmud, not only of Passover concerning the four glasses of wine, but the context also of Purim, the reading of the Megillah, the scroll of Esther, night and morning, and Hanukkah, the mitzvah of lighting the Hanukkah lights. In all these three cases, the four glasses of wine, Passover, the reading of the scroll of Esther on Purim, and the lighting of the Hanukkah lights, these are all rabbinic mitzvot that are positive time bound. They're have to do's as opposed to refrain from doing, and they're for a specific time. And therefore, women should be exempt. But in all of these three cases, concerning the four glasses, concerning the Megillah of Esther, and concerning the Hanukkah lights, the Talmud says that women are obligated in these mitzvot because of this same phrase, because they too were included in that miracle. Now, given all that, what do you think it means? What does it mean? Af hen hayu boto hanes. Even they, women, were included in the miracle. What could that mean?
They left Egypt.
Great. It could mean women left Egypt as well as men. It could mean that women were saved from the decree of Haman, just like men. they were under the decree and they were saved. And as far as Hanukkah goes, well, women were under the decree of Antiochus, just like men, and they were saved just like men. So it means that women and men are part of the same Jewish people. The people as a whole was threatened. The people as a whole were saved. So we all celebrate. Men and women, no differences. And that's certainly what it could mean. And that is what it means, according to many commentators. That women were part of the danger, and women were therefore part of the salvation. Fine. However, there are other commentators that say it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that women were in danger and were saved just like men. It rather means that women were the saviors. And it makes sense, because on Purim, she was the salvation, she was the savior. And because of Esther, all women light, mixed my holidays there, because of Esther, all women have to participate in the reading or the hearing of the reading of the Megillah, of the scroll of Esther, night and day. And the same thing with Hanukkah. Do you know the famous story of the heroine of Hanukkah? No one knows what her name was? Huh? There's one version but the real heroine is Yehudit, Judith. That's why we eat cheese on Hanukkah and dairy products, because the story goes that she seduced the enemy general, Holofernes, and got him with... Well, she seduced him in the sense that she gave him milk to drink, and he fell asleep, and then she cut off his head. So because of Judith, we eat dairy products on Hanukkah, and women are obligated lighting the Hanukkah candles. And now what about Pesach? Remember, we're here about Pesach tonight. It's not Hanukkah, it's not Purim. What about Pesach? What does it mean that Af hen hayu boto hanes, even they were included in that miracle? Well, if you take the first approach, it means that women were under the gzeirah, under the decree of Paro, just like men, and they were saved. Fine. If you take the second approach, that it's about a heroine, so who were the heroines of the salvation of the Jewish people, of the Israelites in Egypt? Who do you think?
Miriam,
right? Miriam. What did she do, by the way?
She saved Moses.
She was very instrumental in saving Moshe.
The midwives.
And the midwives, right? There's an argument if they were Jewish or Egyptian, but according to the view they were Jewish, they certainly were very central in the salvation. Miriam, in looking after her brother and watching the baby in the basket by the Nile and making sure that then the mother came and served as a wet nurse for the baby, right? And of course, the baby's mother, Yocheved, who did what she did to put him in a basket. So there are those four women, the two midwives, and Miriam and Yocheved, who certainly were central in the salvation of the Jewish people, and perhaps the references to them. And also, I'll add Tzipora, because according to the story in chapter 3 of Exodus, God, for some reason, wanted to kill Moshe, but Tzipora saved Moshe from God by circumcising their son. The whole story won't go into it. Perhaps that year, last year, the year before. I don't know. But we're going to see in the Talmud in another 20 minutes that in addition to the two midwives, and in addition to Miriam and Yocheved, the sister and the mother of Moshe respectively, in addition to those four women, there were additional women that the Talmud is thinking of when it says that because of these saviors of the Jewish people, all women are obligated in the mitzvah of the four glasses of wine on Passover. And I'm sure after this class, you'll keep those women in mind as you drink the four glasses on Passover. So now we have to see some of the sources. That's stage number one. Okay? Good. Stage number two is a certain enigma I'm going to mention. I'm going to look at B on the sheet. It's very near the top. And it's from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Psachim, page 116a. It quotes from the Mishnah, from the Code of Jewish Law from the year 200 of the Common Era. And the Mishnah says, Haroset is not a religious requirement. Religious requirement is this translation this particular edition's translation of the word mitzvah, commandment. One opinion says charoset is not a mitzvah. But Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok, Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok, said it is a mitzvah. Charoset is a mitzvah. Now the minute he says it's a mitzvah, we have to ask, well, where does charoset come from? It's not the four glasses of wine that the rabbis instituted. It's not the Pesach sacrifice. It's not the maror. It's not the matzah. It's not mentioned any place in the Torah. What is this charoset stuff? So the Gemara says, why is it a mitzvah? Rabbi Levi said, in memory of the apple tree. And you're probably asking, what apple tree? I don't remember an apple tree in that story.
Were there even apple trees in that area?
Well, the truth is, the reason it's translated apple tree is because of the word which is tapuach. And in modern Hebrew, we call tapuach an apple. But really, historically, we're not sure that the reference is to the fruit that we today call tapuach. It might be something different. But anyway, it's in memory of the apple tree. We'll have to get back to that. Rabbi Yochanan said, in memory of the clay. So that makes sense, right? They had to, as slaves, make these bricks and put them together with clay, teat in Hebrew. So the charoset looks like clay. And it looks like some type of mortar, filler. So that's what the charoset is about. This apple tree stuff, we're wondering. Then it says, Abaye observed. Abaye is a fourth generation Amora rabbi in Babylonia. Therefore, one must make it tart and thicken it. Make it tart in memory of the apple tree, like a tart apple, and thicken it in memory of the clay. Okay, that makes sense. There are two different explanations of what charoset is, where it comes from, and we have to make it. The recipe has to be reflective of both reasons. It was taught in accordance with Rabbi Yochanan, the condiments are in memory of the straw. Which means if you hold that it is in memory of the clay, then when you put in certain
ingredients,
they look like straw, like you might put in sticks of cinnamon, or you might put in a parsley, and it looks like straw. I think of dried out parsley, or other type of spices you might put in that you don't grind up, you leave them to stick out, so it looks like you have clay full of straw. And fine, and that's the way you're supposed to do it. In memory of the straw, because the charoset is in mind of the clay, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Tzadok said, thus did the grocer's cry, come and buy ingredients for your religious requirements. In other words, since we remember, says he, in my childhood, that the vendors used to say, come and buy ingredients and spices for the charoset. And when they said charoset, they said mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. So you see that we hold that it's a mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah, like the first opinion said in the Mishnah here. It really is a mitzvah. And why is it a mitzvah? We said we have two different reasons. One in memory of the clay, one in memory of the apple tree. And I brought this whole account for the apple tree. And I'll leave the apple tree as an enigma until we go on and see what the apple tree has to do with the righteous women who saved the Jewish people, and because of them, all women are obligated in the four glasses of wine. Okay.
One of the good things that Tom has done for me.
Okay. In order not to confuse anyone, I'll just tell you that what I brought here are just the footnotes from the Sansino translation that I used for the portion of the Talmud I brought here. Not that I thought the footnotes were very important, but if you're going to go back and look at it at home, you might want to read the footnotes. Okay, so in order to understand what is this matter of the righteous women that the Talmud alludes to that saved the Jewish people, that made the miracle, and what is the matter of the apple tree, we're going to go back to the Haggadah that we saw last time. I photocopied on the sheet a piece of the Haggadah, but it's also good to see the Haggadot so that you can put things in context. So that one's only Hebrew, and I want to use the one with English so I can tell everyone where we are, so everyone can kind of look around. More or less everyone is, you know, guys don't have one.
But,
so.
But you said you got it here.
Yeah, but I want to see the larger context also.
Oh, okay.
So,
well,
yeah. So what page? On page 15 and 16. We talked last time about different components of the Haggadah, And I mentioned just 10 minutes ago now that in addition to the Pesach Matzah and Maror, the sacrificial lamb and the unleavened bread and the bitter herbs mentioned in the Torah also mentions the mitzvah to tell the story to your children. And that is what we do at the Seder. We have the matzah, we have the maror. If we would have the temple today, we would have the sacrificial lamb. And the main thing we do, what takes up most of the time, is telling the story of the slavery and the freedom of the Exodus. That's what we call mitzvat magid. Magid means to tell. And the primary framework, as we saw last time, for the fulfillment of the mitzvah of magid is a section of four verses from the book of Deuteronomy, which in the Haggadah are printed. In addition to being printed in the Haggadah, what's printed together with each verse is a detailed explanation of each phrase from those four verses. The Haggadah, as remember from last time, quotes one verse, Deuteronomy 26, and then breaks the verse into phrases and explains each phrase. Quotes the second verse, breaks it into phrases and explains the third verse and the fourth verse. That's the center of Mitzvat Magid, and that begins in this particular Maxwell House Haggadah on page 15. Just look around for a second to get your bearings. And at the top of page 15, the Haggadah quotes the verse from Deuteronomy. In this particular translation, a Syrian had nearly caused my father to perish, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there with a few persons, and there became a nation great, mighty, and numerous. And then in the next paragraph, which is most of the page, what the Haggadah does, it quotes now separate phrases from the verse we just quoted and explains them. So that it says, and he went down to Egypt. Right, that's a quote from the verse and explains it. And then it says, and sojourned there and explains it, also from the verse. And then it takes the words, a few persons, and explains it. And then the words, became a nation, explains it. Great, explains it. Mighty, explains it. Numerous, explains. And then we get to the second verse from this section of four verses in Deuteronomy, and it's at the very bottom of the page, beginning with the Hebrew word, Vayareyu otanu hamitzrim, and the Egyptians ill-treated us, afflicted us, and laid heavy bondage upon us. Right, that's the bottom of page 16. 15, I'm sorry. Bottom of page 15. And before we turn the page, I just want to emphasize one of the words in Hebrew, the one that's translated as afflicted us. Vaya'anunu. That's the second to the last line of the page, the last word of that line, vaya'anunu. Does everyone see that word?
Mm-hmm.
Vaya'anunu. I don't remember if we talked about this word last time. Did we talk about inui? Oni? Perhaps not. Okay. So this word is going to take up our attention for a number of minutes tonight. Vaya'anunu, translated as they afflicted us. When we turn the page, the Haggadah, of course, does what I said it does. It now takes every phrase from that verse and brings it separately and then explains it. At the top of page 16, it brings Vayareyu otanu mitzrim, and the Egyptians ill-treated us, and explains. And then it brings, in about line 7, and they afflicted us. In the Hebrew, that is line 5, Vayanunu. Let's just read what it says. And they afflicted us. As it says, they set taskmasters over us to afflict us with their burdens, and they built stone cities for Paro, Pitom, and Ramses. What it's doing here, it's taking a verse from Exodus to explain this phrase from Deuteronomy. The phrase in Deuteronomy says, Vayanunu, they afflicted us. And it brings a verse from Exodus, well, telling the whole story, that has the same word in it, afflicted us. And they afflicted us, as it is said, in Exodus, and they set taskmasters over us to afflict them with their burdens. I'm going to come back to that phrase later. Now, in the middle of the page, it quotes the third verse from the chapter 26 in Deuteronomy, and we cried, you see, Benitzak, it says in blue there, Nitzak, and we cried until the Eternal, the God of our fathers, and the Eternal heard our voice, saw our affliction, our sorrow, and our oppression. And here, again, appears that word, our affliction. That verb seems to come up again and again and again in the Hebrew. It is the first word of the third line of that middle paragraph. Onyenu. Do you see the word onyenu? And now we're going to read. Now we've gotten to the point after all that introduction. We're going to read how the Haggadah explains what it means, our affliction. Onyenu. Oni shalanu. Our affliction. And that is found near the bottom of page 16. Four lines in English from the bottom of the page. The last two words of the line. And he saw our affliction. Right, that's a quote from the verse in Deuteronomy, and the Haggadah is now going to explain it. You ready? This denotes the separation from their wives. And the question is going to be, what? What's the connection between our affliction and, what did you say? Separation from their wives? What does that have to do with anything? And just to make sure that the English is not fooling us, we'll look in the Hebrew. The Hebrew says, it's the second to last line of page 16, the last two words of the line, Zo prishut derech eretz. This is separation of derech eretz, and derech eretz is a euphemism for sexual intimacy. So, vayar et onyenu, God saw our affliction, is understood by the Haggadah, and you've all been saying this every year for who knows how many decades, that our affliction in Egypt was a separation from intimacy, marital intimacy. So now we have to connect all these things. How is it that affliction is separation, marital intimacy? What does that have to do with with the Seder, with the Exodus, and how does that connect to the apple tree, and how does it connect to the heroines of Passover? That's what we're going to do tonight.
Did the Hebrew word for affliction change between Vayenu
no.
and the
Otsu? It's always the same root. Onyenu is the same word as Inui, the same word as Oni, right? Oni, Onyenu. It's all the same. The same root. Okay. On the sheet that I gave out, I took a bit of the Haggadah and just brought a few there so it can all be on the sheet, but I wanted to see it in the Haggadah to see context. Okay. I wrote at the bottom of this first sheet, the very bottom, where it says number one at the bottom, what might be the source of the assertion of the Haggadah that our affliction, onyenu, refers to the separation between husband and wife. Where does this come from? So I want to start searching. So the first place that my sheet says to look is in Shmot 21:10. Shmot, we can open up the Humashim, or the Tanachim, whatever you might have. You have it on there? You can also have it here if you want. Anyone need?
I'll share with you.
Do you want that, Alexandria? 21:10 of the book of Exodus. This is Parshat Mishpatim, all of the civil law that's given to us here. And in 21:10, we have the very, very common story that everyone, of course, has come across, is selling your daughter as a maidservant. You don't like my jokes, what can I do? So the context is in verse 7, when a man says his daughter is a slave, she should not be freed as the male slaves are, etc., etc., etc. Verse 10, if he marries another, if the man who bought her in order to marry her also marries another, takes a second wife, he must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. Now, the word in Hebrew for conjugal rights is onata. I put it on the sheet at the very last line there, onata. And you can just listen to the word onata, her ona, and it sounds right like oni,
yeah.
Right? The same word affliction. And you begin to see the connection, perhaps. The word Oni, Onyenu, has been explained by the Haggadah to mean separation of husband and wife. And then you have the same word, Onata, her, Ona, that refers to conjugal relationships. So you begin to see perhaps that word Oni, which we translate as affliction, does have something to do with male-female intimacy. But not so quickly. The truth is the word Ona, as it appears here in Exodus, meaning conjugal rights, there are three good reasons why this is not the source for what the rabbi said in the Haggadah, that Onyenu, our affliction, refers to the nullification of marital intimacy. There's three good reasons why it doesn't come from here. One is because the word Onata, that appears here in Exodus, sounds like the same root as Oni, but it's not. It's actually a different root. It's from the word that means season or cycle. It doesn't mean affliction. And secondly, as you can see in the notes here at the bottom of the page, it's not even clear that the word onata means conjugal rites. Others translate as ointments. In other words, as perfumes. And a third reason that this is not the source what we're looking for is because even if the word onata here in Exodus does mean conjugal rites, and even if it were to be the same root as the word we're working with in Deuteronomy, they would mean the opposite. Because here it means conjugal rites, and in Deuteronomy we're talking about the lack of that. The opposite. The separation, not the connection between husband and wife. So in those three accounts, this is not the direction we want to go in. We have to look for a different place, a different source to understand how the rabbis of the Haggadah understood that Onyenu, our affliction, means the separation between husband and wife. I have to look for a different source. So we go to the top of the back of the page, and in about line 6 there, it says we have to move to answer this question to Sefer Shemot, chapter 1, verses 8 to 22. So here we go. Right, 8 to 22. At the beginning of the book of Exodus, the beginning of the story of our slavery. And Carol Ann was present in a class I gave in these verses last week, so she knows how I started getting the idea of what we're doing tonight. So we're going to read Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 to 22. Very beginning of the book of Exodus. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. In other words, Yosef had died, and this new king didn't appreciate, perhaps didn't even know, all Yosef had done for the land of Egypt. And he said to his people, the new king said to the Egyptians, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them, so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground," which means they might join our enemies, "and cause us, the Egyptians, to rise from the land, to have to flee the land." So they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built garrison cities for Paro, Pitom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks and with all sorts of tasks in the field. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Puah, saying, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, letting the boys live?" The midwives said to Paro, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they have given birth." And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and increased greatly. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Whatever that means, we won't go into it. Then Paro charged all his people, saying, every boy that is born you shall throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Okay. That's the story of the beginning of our enslavement.
So the midwives lied to the Pharaoh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So Anne had already read this story. Did you say midwives?
No.
We all should know it a little bit. Now I took a bite of the cookie. I have to talk more.
We can wait.
So, really only in the past week did I realize a very clear truth in this chapter that we just read. And that is that it says explicitly that the whole aim of the Egyptian enslavement was to make sure there'll be less Israelites. It says explicitly, verse 10 that we just read, let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. So in verse 11, when it says they set taskmasters over them, the purpose of the forced labor is not economic. It's not because the Egyptians need the labor. It's because they want to do something to make sure there'll be less Israelites. And I put on the sheet here three possible understandings in the bullet points of why or how slavery in Paro's mind would be a means of, let's call it, partial genocide. Either through demoralization, so they won't want to procreate. In other words, they'll say, what's the point of having children? We're slaves. Or through sapping their physical strength, so they won't have any desire for intimacy. Or by leaving them no time or opportunity to engage in intimacy. One of those three reasons, or all three together, must have been, according to the simple reading of the verses here, the purpose of Paro in these gzerot, in these decrees. It wasn't because he needed any economic benefit. It was just a means towards a different end, because he's afraid of the multiplication of the Israelites. They're procreating too quickly. And really, there's a phrase here in Hebrew that's not clear in the English translation, but really strengthens this point. And I'm referring to verse 11. Let's go back to verse 11 of chapter 1. I'll read it the way it's here in the JPS translation, then I'll ask if others have a different translation. You might have a different translation, and Alexandria might have a different translation, and Artswell might have a different translation. This translation says, so they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. Okay, what does yours say?
And they set commanders of work companies over it in order to degrade it with their burdens.
Okay, so that translation might be a little better because it has the in order that's missing from my translation. That's here in the Hebrew, lema'an, in order that. Charles, what does yours say?
So they appointed taskmasters over it in order to afflict.
In
it.
Order to afflict, okay.
You have the order. Afflict it with their burdens.
Okay, and Alexandria?
Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens.
To afflict. Okay, so your translation just has two, like mine does, and the translation here has in order to. It does say in order to in the Hebrew. But of course, there's a good reason not to translate in order to, because what does it fit? Why do you have to say in order to? But I think we understand now the in order to. Because, read it again. So they set taskmasters over them in order to degrade, oppress them with forced labor. So what do you hear? That, just one more second, that the labor is not the point. It's in order to do something through the labor.
Well, you can kill 90% of the men. If you leave the same amount of women, you can have the same amount of kids. So the strategy doesn't make sense.
Right. Many commentators have asked that question. And I've seen a number of different answers to that. One of them is that perhaps what Paro was really afraid of was soldiers.
Well, that makes that would be more logical for one generation to kill the men. But if you're worried about long-term population, it doesn't make sense.
Anyway, but I think there's no way around the verse that said Paro's problem was with the multiplication of the population. So, yeah.
Maybe I should know this, but I don't remember.
I'm not going to embarrass you.
What did the Israelites do to warrant this treatment?
Multiply.
No, but were they a threat to Pharaoh? What did they do when they moved it from Canaan into Egypt that would warrant this affliction?
Multiply.
No, that's not the answer. It's not just because I multiplied. Because they were different, because they were a threat, because they didn't worship the same gods?
I'm not a historian. I'd only know what the verses say. We just read the verse.
It doesn't explain what the Israelites did to warrant this treatment. It said,
multiply.
Whatever they did, we're going to stop them from multiplying.
But historically, that is often when a different people begins to increase in number, it creates a friction within any multi-ethnic nation. From the Ottoman Empire, Yugoslavia.
And it does say that the Pharaoh was not did not know them. I mean, implying that maybe it was a different Pharaoh that didn't have that relationship with the Jews like the ones did before. They didn't remember how wonderful, you know, how they saved the world from famine and such as that. And as the Jews began to multiply, this Pharaoh didn't know them. All he saw was that they seemed to be a threat because they worship a different god, and Pharaoh was God, and these people didn't worship him as a god.
That all could be.
And with growth came power.
Say it again.
And with growth
comes power. And they're different. They're just different. And of course...
Well,
you know what? I would say that if you are perplexed, well, then I'll say that we're all perplexed by anti-Semitism throughout the generations. Why? And it's the same answer. Because there's lots of them, and they're different. But any rational reason other than that doesn't have to be. Jim?
I don't recall the specific people, but I think that there was an incident prior to this where there were peoples that had wreaked havoc on the Egyptian empires. And I'd want to go back and look at it. My recollection was his foreign presence.
What threat did we pose to Hitler?
No, I understand that. I have heard an Orthodox rabbi compare the Exodus to the Holocaust, or what was happening in Egypt. And so I understand your point, but I can go read the history books.
Based on the text, there's nothing.
You've mentioned this before too, but the gradual afflictions that they put on, I shouldn't use that word since we're using it in a different context, but the things that they continue to put on the force. First they just put them in garrison cities, and then they had forced labor, and just like in the Nazis, where they just, you know, one regulation after another until it just got worse and worse and worse until finally they're slaves, just like in the Holocaust when Jews were just, you know, considered animals. Hurt them up and kill them.
So going back to the verse we're looking at, so we remember that we learned in verse 10, says clearly the fear of Paro is the natural increase, and his purpose is to stem that natural increase. And then verse 11 said, so they set taskmasters over them in order to oppress them with the labor. So you hear that the labor is not the purpose, it's not economic, it's in order to oppress them. Now, if we learned that the purpose of Paro is to make less and less Israelites, and then it says that he put labor upon them in order to oppress them, you would say, so oppress must mean something that makes less Israelites. Now, what is the word oppress here? In my translation, it's oppress. Yours is the grade. Yours was, remember what the word was? Which was yours? In order to?
Oppress
Afflict. And that would be the best translation, because the word in Hebrew is anoto. It's the same word in Deuteronomy that the rabbi said means separation from their wives. It's the same word in here, in verse 11, that says he put labor upon them in order to afflict them. So put two and two together. Right? If it says here in Shemot that the purpose is to make less Israelites, then it says he put labor upon them in order to afflict them. And we know his purpose is less Israelites. So afflict must mean something about making less Israelites. That's the source for the rabbis in Deuteronomy. This is the word afflict there means less Israelites. Pre-shoot derech eretz. Canceling intimacy. You understand what I'm saying? The rabbi simply read Deuteronomy in light of Exodus. They read the word onyenu in light of the word anoto, the same root, in Exodus. And all makes perfect sense. So it must be that this forced labor wasn't an end in itself. It was a means towards stemming procreation. Again, according to the one of the three ways that I mentioned earlier, either demoralization or sapping physical strength or leaving no time or opportunity, but it's all about destroying family structure. And that's how the rabbis got to what they got in the Haggadah, explaining the word onyenu in Deuteronomy. So it really makes great sense. Doesn't it make great sense?
Yes.
So now...
Yeah, but it can't be that simple. I don't know. You always throw the zinger in it.
No, it is. It's that simple. It's all that simple. But the next stage is as follows. Where on the sheet where it says two, in the middle of the back sheet, the question now is as follows. Were Paro's methods successful? Was marital intimacy stymied?
Nope.
You say no, and how do you know?
Verse 12
says, but the more they were pressed, the more they increased and spread out, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. So it says clearly in verse 12 that Pharaoh's efforts to prevent more and more Israelite children from being born, his efforts were unsuccessful. Correct.
But that's because the midwives didn't cooperate.
Chronology. Right? Wait a second, everything in order.
The women also.
You have to be pregnant to have midwives not cooperate.
You certainly do. You certainly do.
They had to be together.
So, verse 11, let's do things in order here. Because remember, this whole chapter is about, as Caroline said, a gradated imposition of worse and worse measures, all for the same purpose. So, verse 11 was about forced labor in order to. Anoto, in order to prevent intimacy. Verse 12 said it didn't work, right? But the more they oppressed him, it's the same word, the more they did anoto, the more they tried to prevent intimacy, the more they increased. But then verse 13 says that Paro stepped up the measures and made it worse. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly, they made life bitter for them with harsh labor, mortar and bricks, with all sorts of tasks in the field, and that seems to be another level in the tightening of the noose. It didn't work just to make them slaves. They kept having children, so Pharaoh made it worse. And now he imposed ruthless labor on them, which might mean labor that really doesn't accomplish anything, just in order to make life terrible, like dig a pit and cover it up. Dig a pit and cover it up. Dig a pit and uncover it. It's not about, again, it's not about building pyramids. It's not about getting some economic benefit. It's about destroying their will to procreate or their strength to procreate or their opportunity to procreate. And at the end of verses 13 and 14, it doesn't say that the efforts of Paro were unsuccessful. It doesn't say they were successful. We don't know. It says in verse 12 they were, at that stage, unsuccessful. But Gzeirot, when the decrees got stronger, we don't know how successful or unsuccessful Paro was. Now, it's true in verse 15, he calls to the midwives and says, kill the male children. But that doesn't mean that his previous level of enactment against the Israelites was unsuccessful. It could be there was 50% success, but the rest of the children that are born, he wants to get them also. We don't know if it was successful or not.
Okay, first of all, this was not one pharaoh. This was over 400 years, right?
So it was not necessarily. We don't know.
Well, we were slaves for 400 years.
Well, the rabbis do a computation, and they say that we're in Egypt only 210 years, not 400.
Okay, but even if it was 200 years.
No. But just Egypt for 210 years. That includes all the life of Joseph when he was in prison, all the time that his brothers were there and he was still alive, all the time that the previous pharaoh who remembered Yosef was still alive. The slavery might only have been, according to the Bible, 60 or 70 years, perhaps even just 50. There's different computations. It might have been only a generation and a half, two generations.
So we spent our whole life saying we were slaves for 400 years, and you're telling us now we were slaves for 20 years?
I'm trying to make life easier for you. Be a little bit better about your Judaism. It's not all slavery. The truth is, I've also said to my kids that, remember how you were slaves, and your father was a slave, and your grandfather was a slave, but really, it could be it was only between 50 and 70 years.
So what's with earlier when God says you'll be a slave for 400 years in Egypt?
It's a problem, but according to the chronology, it looks like it's 400 years from the time that was spoken to Abraham until the Exodus. You do the math, just with the ages of people when they had children, when they were married, it just doesn't work out. So 210 years.
So how could they multiply so quick?
I leave that to mathematicians, but mathematicians...
It takes more than mathematicians to do that. Because who went there first? It was, who went to Egypt originally? I thought it said it was just a handful of
70,
people.
70.
Then you're at 600,000 when they leave.
But just
well,
let me...
210 years, that's a lot of generations.
Right. Yeah. When I say that the slavery was only between 50 and 70 years, that doesn't mean that they turned from 70 to 600,000 in 70 years. For that, they had the full period of time. They were doing something during that time, when they weren't slaves. So, I want now to go back to that verse in Deuteronomy that has the word in it, Onyenu, our affliction, that the rabbis have explained means our separation from our wives. We can read that verse in the Haggadah. We could read it in Deuteronomy chapter 26, but let's read in the Haggadah. We don't have to open another book. So that was in the middle of page 16 in our Maxwell House Haggadah. So, v'nitzak, and we cried. And we cried unto the Eternal, the God of our fathers, and the Eternal heard our voice, sore our affliction, our sorrow, and our oppression. So I want to say as follows. God sore our affliction. V'yar et onyenu, he sore our onyenu. And if onyenu, our affliction, means the cancellation of marital intimacy, that implies that Paro's decree was successful. Because God sore our affliction. Affliction means separation of husband and wife. That means there was separation of husband and wife. I rest my case. Right? So if there was onyenu, there was affliction, which means pre-shoot derech eretz, separation of husband and wife, that means to a certain degree at least, the decree was successful and there was affliction. There was separation. So if you read that back into Exodus, and I'm saying all this to understand another level of rabbinic interpretation we're about to get to, if you read this back into Exodus, it means that although in verse 12 it says, the more they were oppressed, the more they increased. But then verse 13 says, the Egyptians ruthlessly imposed. They stepped up the ordinances and they tightened the noose. It must be that there was success. Paro had success because there was onyenu, there was our affliction. And there was, therefore, as the rabbis say, separation between husband and wife. Now, if it was successful, then how in the end was Moshe born? Because it says, chapter 2, a certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. His name was Moshe, etc. So if we're saying there was onyenu, there was pre-shoot derech eretz, there was separation between husband and wife, then how is it that Moshe was born? How did the Jewish people continue it all? We should have become extinct in Egypt if there was onyenu, there was separation between husband and wife. And I say all that in order to provide the background to a set of midrashim that we're about to see that I think are going to be interesting and exciting and surprising. There are three midrashim we're going to look at. One is an introduction to the other two, and then the two of them. So here we go. It's the bottom of this backside of the page. I called it D. And the first source is a midrash from a collection called Avkir that's available in a later anthology called Yalkut Shimoni, a D. And it says like this. Ruthlessly they made life bitter for them with hard labor at mortar and bricks with all sorts of tasks in the field. That's our verse 14, right? That I claim Paro was successful with. And look what the Midrash says. The Midrash says, were they working in the fields? Was it not in the city? Rather, the Egyptians had decreed that the Israelite men should sleep out in the fields while the women slept in the cities in order to prevent them from multiplying further. Now, of course, the Midrash is a Midrash. It's not written in the text, as the Midrash says. It doesn't say that Paro forcibly separated men and women. But we can understand where the Midrash is coming from. After all we saw just now, right? We understand. Thank you. We understand that if the purpose of these ordinances was to make sure there'd be less and less Israelites born, then it could very well be that part of the slavery was an overt decree that separated men and women. And if that was the decree and it was observed, it means again that Paro was successful. And there was separation between husband and wife. And that's the background now to the next set of Midrashim from Tractate Sotah, page 11b. And I forgot to write Babylonian Talmud. I'll just write that in. Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, they changed men's work for the women and women's work for the men. Notice they made the women make bricks and they made the men work in Paro's kitchen. And you might say to yourself, where did they get that from? Where did they get that from? But it could be that we understand now where they got it from. Because if the purpose of all of this slavery was not so much for Egypt's economic benefit, but was to disrupt normal family life, well, one of the ways you can do that is by confusing societal roles and causing a degradation of one's sense of self. And in a society that has strong male-female roles, one of the easiest ways to destroy one's sense of human dignity is to make him do or her do a role that belongs to the other sex. And the rabbis probably said what they said here in order to make the point that there's a purpose to the slavery. The purpose was to degrade them. He used the word degrade in your translation. Degrade them so they'd no longer see a point in marital relations and in developed families and in sustaining the next generation. Obviously, if you give men women's work and women men's work, you're not going to get much economic benefit out of it. But you're going to get a lot of a sense of degradation, a lot of a sense of humiliation. And you're going to destroy family life. And that's probably what the rabbis are trying to say. And in that context, it makes perfect sense. It's just like the stories in the Holocaust of dig a pit and cover it up, dig a pit and cover it up. It's not for the economic benefit. It's to take from people their sense of human worth. And then the Midrash goes on to say, Rabbi Avira expounded, as a reward for the righteous women who lived in that generation, were the Israelites delivered from Egypt. There's the sentence that I use as a title to this class. What righteous women are you talking about? Of course, there's Yocheved and Miriam and the midwives, as we already saw. But now the rabbi is going to say there's more than that. When they went to draw water, and he means the women, the Holy One, blessed be He, arranged that small fishes should enter their pitchers. which they drew up half full of water and half full of fishes. Then they set two pots on the fire, one for hot water and the other for the fish, which they carried to their husbands in the field and washed, anointed, fed, gave them to drink, and had intercourse with them among the sheepfolds. And I won't read on for a second. So just imagine what this graphic midrash is saying. It's saying that the women had to seduce the men. Why? Because the men weren't seducing the women, obviously. In other words, it's describing a situation in which Paro was 100% successful. And either because of ideological reasons, so the men saying there's no point in procreation because we're all slaves, or because of physical reasons, they just didn't have the strength or the time or the opportunity. For one of those three reasons, according to the Midrash, the men have said, forget it. No point. The end of the Jewish people. We're finished. And according to the Midrash, although Paro was successful with the men, he wasn't successful with the women. And the women took it upon themselves, in a very untraditional and provocative fashion, to arouse their husbands to sexuality by going onto the field and anointing and feeding and giving drink, etc. Even among the sheepfold, it's not very modest. It's in the middle of the field, according to this midrash, all these men and women are having engaging in intimacy among the sheepfolds. As it is said, I'm reading on, when you lie among the sheepfolds, etc. And that's a verse from the book of Psalms, which, believe me, we don't have time to look at it, has nothing to do with our context. But the rabbis interpret it to mean that in the sheepfolds there, in other words, in the open fields, there was something going on between husband and wife. As the reward for when ye lie among the sheepfolds, as reward for all of this initiative that these women took upon themselves, the Israelites merited the spoliation of the Egyptians, which means merited to get a lot of wealth out of the Exodus, as is described in our sources, that they borrowed, asked to borrow from their neighbors, dresses and clothing and gold and silver, and they came out of Egypt with all that. It was a reward for this initiative of the Jewish women. And it brings a verse then from Psalms, as the wings of a dove covered with silver and her pinions with yellow gold. The context, nothing to what we're talking about, but according to the Midrash, the wings of the dove is the Jewish people. We came out of Egypt with silver and with gold. Now look what the Midrash goes on to say. We'll find our apple tree now. Mm-hmm. After the women had conceived, they returned to their homes, and when the time of childbirth arrived, they went and were delivered in the field. Why the field? Because if you stay at home, Paro's going to get you. He's looking for the firstborn. I'm sorry, looking for the males. Delivered in the field beneath the apple tree. There's our apple tree. As it is said, under the apple tree I cause thee to come forth. That's a quote from a verse in Cantillations. That's how you say in English, Cantillations?
Song of Songs.
Song of Songs. How do you say in English? Cantillations. Yeah, Cantillations.
Cantillations or Cantations?
Ask me, I don't know. Anyway, in Hebrew, Shira Shirim, the Song of Songs, which you know is a love song between boy and girl, husband and wife. And it talks there about under the apple tree. And according to the rabbis, that's the apple tree in the field there. The field where the husband and wife had relations and where the woman came later to give birth under the apple tree. Is there a song about that?
Yes. But don't go under the apple tree with anyone else but
yeah,
me.
That's right from this midrash. Anything else in the... Does the song... anything else in the song that's about Egypt?
No.
Slavery?
No. That's the only part I know. Just like, you know, just don't go, you know, don't go being under the apple tree with anybody else.
But I would venture a guess that that song comes from here.
So, the Jewish composer?
Probably.
Okay, so under the apple tree I cause thee to come forth from thy mother's womb. Now, the Holy One, blessed be He, sent down an emissary from the high heavens, like, you know, like an angel or something, a malach, who washed and straightened the limbs of the babes in the same manner that a midwife straightens the limbs of a child. Because they didn't have midwives, because they had fled from the city to get away from Paro. They were all alone, they gave birth, but God made it okay. And it brings a verse. And as for thy nativity, in the day thou was born, thy navel was not cut, neither was thou washed in water to cleanse thee. And that's as if it were describing our children here born in Egypt in the field with no doctor, no midwife. That's a verse from Ezekiel. And this verse I want to look up, because it's going to come back in the Haggadah. So let's go to Ezekiel, Yechezkel, chapter 16, verse 4. Ezekiel 16, 4. In my translation, it's page 911. Ezekiel comes after Jeremiah, that comes after Isaiah, that comes after Kings. 16. So I'm going to read here a few verses from Ezekiel 16 and then 4 and henceforth. 16:4. As for your birth, when you were born, your navel cord was not cut, and you were not bathed in water to smooth you. You were not rubbed with salt, nor were you swaddled. Now, of course, the verse has nothing to do in its context with Egypt or slavery, but that doesn't matter. It's being used here in a creative midrash. Goes on to say, no one pitied you enough to do any one of these things for you out of compassion for you. On the day you were born, you were left lying, rejected in the open field. Ah, open field. The rabbi said, yeah, open field under the apple tree. When I passed by you, and this is God talking, and saw you wallowing in your blood without any midwife to take care of you, I said to you, live in spite of your blood. I said to you, live in spite of your blood. By the way, in spite of doesn't have to be. It could be live in your blood. We'll get back to that. I let you grow like the plants in the field, and you continued to grow up until you attained to womanhood, until your breast became firm and your hair sprouted, etc., etc., etc. That verse, by the way, is in the Haggadah. We'll get back to it if we have time. This whole set of verses in Ezekiel 16, 4, 5, 6, and 7 is understood by the rabbis as a description of what we're talking about, of the Jews being born in Egypt. But let's go back to the Midrash. He also provided for them two cakes, and God provided two cakes for the newborns, one of oil, one of honey, as it is said, and he made him suck honey out of the rock and oil, etc. When the Egyptians noticed them, these babies in the field with their mothers, they went to kill them, but a miracle occurred on their behalf, so they were swallowed in the ground, and the Egyptians brought oxen and plowed over them. As it is said, the plow was plowed upon my back. Again, the verse has nothing to do with this, but the rabbis creatively connect it. After they had departed, the Egyptians, the Israelite women with their babes broke through the earth and came forth like the herbage of the field. As it is said, I caused thee to multiply the plants of the field. And that's the verse we just read in Ezekiel. So the image is, so Charles asked earlier, how did we multiply in Egypt so many? According to the rabbis, we multiplied like weeds. Like weeds, right? We miraculously went underground like potatoes, and the Egyptians came and plowed us under in order to kill us, but it actually worked, like plowing often works, to stimulate growth, and we grew up like weeds. And that's the verse that we just read in Ezekiel 16:7, I let you grow like the plants of the field, which the rabbis interpret as we just read. And that verse is in the Haggadah. I'm going back to the Midrash on my sheet. And when the babes had grown up, they came in flocks to their homes. In other words, now the image is not plants and weeds, the image is as flocks of animals. Lots and lots of babies were born in the field, right? And then they went underground and came up like plants, like weeds. And then they came home in flocks to their houses, as is said, and thou didst increase and wax great and had come with ornaments. That verse 11 is also there in Ezekiel. That was verse the second half of verse 7 in chapter 16, just translated differently. The Hebrew is very hard, so there are different translations. And the rabbi said that it means they came home in adarim, in flocks. That's the story. finished. And there's a lot of interesting things there. Of course, it's wild. And it's funny. And it's certainly, you know, a sermon that wakes people up. But what's the point? What's behind all this funniness? So we learned that according to the rabbis, reading the verse in Deuteronomy, according to the verse in Exodus, that Onyenu, God saw our affliction, means that God saw our separation from our spouses. If Paro was successful, but if he was successful, how could it be that ultimately more children were born and we were redeemed from Egypt? So the rabbi's answer is that Paro was successful, but with the men. He wasn't successful with the women. The men were demoralized. The men had no strength. The men wanted to put an end to procreation, to families, to the Jewish people. But the women had unbelievable faith and perseverance and belief and loyalty. And they took extra special efforts to arouse their husbands to intimacy. And as a result of that intimacy, the next generation was born and the Jewish people were saved. So who are, according to this Midrash, who are the righteous women? That because of them, we drink 4 glasses of wine on Pesach, not just men, but women also. It's every single Jewish woman. They're the righteous women who save the Jewish people through their faith and through their willingness to audaciously break with traditional roles and go out to the fields and seduce their husbands. That's a pretty interesting role model, right? And these are the women that because of them, we drink 4 glasses of wine on Passover according to the Midrash. And although this Midrash is not explicit in the Haggadah, it's assumed, because the Haggadah says that there was pre-shoot derech eretz, there was separation of husband and wife, and that begs the question, if there was, so how did we get here today? The answer is in the Midrash. But that's not the only Midrash that answers our question. There's another Midrash, a competing Midrash, that is a different answer to the same question, and we still have a little bit of time for that. So this other Midrash is at the bottom of the page we're looking at on my sheet. It's Tractate Sota, page 12a, just one page after the previous Midrash. It says as follows. And there went a man of the house of Levi. That verse is the first verse of chapter 2 of Exodus. Now there's after it says that Paro was successful and the men separated from their wives, and then Paro commanded the midwives to kill the firstborn. I did it again, to kill the males. And then Paro commanded all of his men and his forces to throw the children into the Nile. Then it says that there was a man from the house of Levi that married a woman from the house of Levi, and Moshe was born of that union. And of course, we're going to ask, wait a second, how did they get married if we just read about the demoralization and all that type of stuff? And the pre-shoot derech eretz, the separation of man and wife. The rabbis say, where did he go? The verse says, and there went the man of the house of Levi and married a daughter of Levi. Why doesn't it just say marry? Why he went and married? Where did he go? The answer is, Rabbi Yehuda ben Zevina said that he went in the counsel of his daughter. He had a study session with his daughter. His daughter told him to get married. His daughter told him to get married. That's a little bit out of order here. Yeah. What's going on? A Tana taught, a rabbi taught, Amram, that's the man in question, the father of Moshe, was the greatest man of his generation. When he saw that the wicked Paro had decreed, quote, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, end quote, he said, Amram said, in vain do we labor. And labor here, in vain do we have children. In vain do we raise up families. He arose and divorced his wife. After he had some children. He said, no point anymore in having more. All the Israelites thereupon arose and divorced their wives. His daughter said to him, daughter who had been born earlier, that's the daughter that we call Miriam, Father, thy decree is more severe than Paro's, because Paro decreed only against the males, whereas thou hast decreed against the males and the females. No kids will be born, not even girls. Paro, she said, only decreed concerning this world, whereas thou hast decreed concerning this world and the world to come. Because if Paro would kill the girls, but they would live for future life in the next world, but if they're not born, then there'll be no next world for anyone. And she continued, in the case of the wicked Paro, there is doubt whether his decree will be fulfilled or not. Perhaps we could circumvent it. Whereas in thy case, thou art righteous. It is certain that thy decree will be fulfilled, because all the Jewish people follow what you did. You divorced your wife, all the other men did as well. And then it says in the last line of the paragraph, he arose and took his wife back. And they all arose and took their wives back. In other words, that's our verse that says, there was a man of the house of Levi, he went and married a daughter of Levi. Where did he go? He went in the counsel of his daughter, who told him, remarry my mother after you divorced her. And he followed her advice, and he got married again, and he took to wife. I'm leaving the rest two lines of the page. Should have read, he took back. Why does it say he took to wife? It doesn't say took back. Rabbi Yehuda ben Zvina said he acted towards her, his wife, as though it was their first marriage. He seated her in a palanquin, which is English translation for a beautiful throne, made a big marriage. Aaron and Miriam danced before her, and the ministering is proclaimed a joyful mother of children. So, according to this midrash, many points are analogous or similar to the previous midrash. According to both midrashim, Paro was successful. The men decided there'd be no more procreation. According to both midrashim, the day was saved by women who prevailed upon the men to return to normal marital relations. And in both cases, the way that the women succeeded was through a role reversal. We usually expect that men seduce, and here in one midrash it's the women that seduced. In the other midrash we expect that men, at least in those days, are active intellectually in the Beit Midrash, but it was the woman who argued against her father and proved to him that his approach was wrong. So in both of these midrashim, Paro wins against the men but fails against the women. The women outsmart Paro and rise up with faith and perseverance and ingenuity, reversing normally expected female roles and taking initiative to save the Jewish people. What's different between the midrashim is the fashion in which Paro succeeded with the men and the fashion in which the women circumvented him. In the first midrash, Paro succeeded on a physical level. He just sapped the men of all their strength. And the women reversed his decree, as it were, by seducing their husbands on the physical level. Okay. According to the second midrash, Paro's success was on the intellectual level. He demoralized them, and they said there's no point in having children anymore. It was intellectual, not physical. And the way that the women overcame that was intellectual, by the daughter, Miriam, proving to her father that his Talmudic reasoning, his Talmudic logic, was mistaken. And she convinced her father, according to, as we said, both sets of Midrashim, were answering a textual question. If indeed Paro was successful, onyeno, male-female separation, that took place, how was the salvation affected in the end? The answer is, the women overcame Paro's success with the men. So just, yeah.
Has anyone ever thought about that maybe the Pharaoh thought there would be a savior of the Jewish people, and the reason he was killing the men was not necessarily, because this whole thing seems so inept, you know, in terms of a way to control population.
There's a midrash like you're saying.
Right.
Midrash
where
that says,
he knew like a savior was coming.
Right.
The savior would be a male, so I'll kill all the males because I don't know who the savior was.
Yeah, there's such a midrash. It's way of looking at things. I think that this way of looking at things fits quite well into the verses. So I just want to emphasize our cycle has come full circle, going back to our original matter. So according to these midrashim, which again are assumed by the Haggadah, according to this midrashim, when we sit down to the Seder and men and women drink the four cups, it is really because of a commemoration of the greatness and the ingenuity and the perseverance of the women of the generation. and just think of the role models we have here. It's not what you'd expect. These are pretty risque midrashim, and the paradigms of feminine salvation that they're suggesting are quite powerful. The first midrash tells a woman to leave behind, how should I call it, sexual passivity, and take action to save the Jewish people by arousing her husband, your husband, to action. That's a powerful model. The second midrash is even perhaps more powerful. The second midrash is saying that it was feminine wisdom in the Beit Midrash, Talmudic logic, feminine Talmudic logic in taking initiative, that the daughter of the greatest rabbi of the generation argued against her father and succeeded, and he accepted her position, and on the basis of that, he led the whole nation to remarry their wives. That's a very, very powerful model, role model. And again, all that is implied in those four glasses of wine that we drink at the Seder.
So, one step further. Does it mean that the men in those days were more open to what the women said, whereas later on they're not?
Is this a personal question?
No, it's true.
What type of answer could I give to that question?
They're right there.
It is a miracle after all.
I started the class with the and wrapped it up with the proposition that that's why women are commanded to observe this positive time bound very quickly. But why the four cups?
The other mitzvot of the night each have their own reason for women being obligated. It looks like this principle of obligation, because they were in the miracle, or because they were leaders of the miracle, only applies to rabbinic mitzvot, to lighting the Ner Hanukkah, the Hanukkah lights, to reading the Megillah and Purim, and to the one rabbinic mitzvah that we have during the Seder. All the other mitzvot are Torah mitzvot. And they have their own reason for women being obligated, even though they're positive time bound. So I don't know of any particular relationship between wine and women.
Nobody said
you're saying that the four cups were created so that there would be...
Oh, no.
My question is,
no.
Why the four cups?
No, they were created for whatever reason they were created.
Okay.
And women should be exempt. But since there are rabbinic mitzvah that's positive time bound, and then we have this principle that goes from there. Yeah.
So our wine will taste.
Yes, I have some of
them. Okay. Good night. Have a happy Passover.
Thank you.
Kosher Passover.
Shavuot Ba'en Shu.
In Shu.
You're going back to Israel when?
I'm going back to Israel.